My name's Dr. Scott Mitchell. I'm an emergency department doctor. I'm actually based down in Guernsey in the Channel Islands. Compared to the UK itself, we're in a very good position with the only cases of COVID being people in isolation from travel within. So our lives are generally pretty normal. You can go to the pub here, you can go to the restaurant with no restrictions whatsoever. But my angle on this is kind of goes back to around middle of March of last year, when we were seeing the sort of horrific images and situations coming out of first China and then Italy, where this virus that, yes, originated in China and then started spreading around the world was, causing overwhelming of healthcare, intensive care. And I say those pictures were particularly coming out of Italy. And I kind of thought, what can we do about this? Because the signs were they were putting people on ventilators for respiratory failure, and a lot of them were dying. So I kind of thought the recommendations from the WHO and whatever were just to give supportive care, which, as I say, was just to stick people on ventilators. But what more could we do? So I got in touch with this doctor or professor, rather, who's called Paul Marrick, who's based at East Virginia Medical School. Because I saw the police, so I saw the doctors in China were kind of using a little bit of intravenous vitamin C to try and treat this disease. Paul Marrick had some good results, although contested by a lot of the medical profession, using vitamin C, steroids, thiamine in particular, to treat sepsis with great success. So I got in touch with them and communicated a lot. Things moved on, and sort of a group of us got together, which was mainly him and a few other ICU doctors, emergency doctors based in North America. And one of us, another of us in Europe, based in Norway, who just sort of put our heads together and tried to work out how to treat this disease. Now, you might remember that we didn't really have any effective treatment for this. The first thing that came out was that was reduced deaths was the use of steroids in hospitalized patients with low oxygen. That was kind of accepted by the medical profession at large after the large-scale recovery trial that was based out of Oxford. I think they had over 2,000 patients given steroids, as opposed to about 4,000 something controls that reduced deaths to particularly patients on ventilation, but also on patients that were requiring oxygen in hospital. And our group had studied this and followed what was going on the front lines and realized that this was working. And you might be able to find, you'll be able to find if you look back, Dr. Pierre Coria works with us. He testified before the Senate in the US. I think that was at the beginning of May, weeks before the recovery trial data came out, stating, steroids are reducing death in COVID patients. So all we've been doing is, looking at the literature, looking at the science, and trying to find out how we can treat this disease otherwise. And it's just been lately, it's a bit of an odd story, really. Going back, there's been a lot of therapies suggested. You probably remember hydroxychloroquine, which is a anti-malaria drug that was particularly touted by Trump back in March. It's kind of not been proven to work, certainly in hospitalized patients. Again, that was another arm of the recovery trial. But maybe some indications that might work early on in the disease to try and stop people getting in hospital, particularly in combination with zinc. But the data really wasn't very strong. However, there's been this other drug called ivermectin that's kind of been flying under the radar for a while. It's been around, well, been around since 1975, and I believe used in about 3.7 billion doses worldwide for actually treatment of parasites. So you might question why a drug that's used for parasites might be effective against a virus. So going back to April again, there was a study came out of Australia that they looked at this in the lab and found that it was, suppressing and knocking off the virus within about 48 hours. Now, not everything that you use in the lab translates into efficacy in humans. You could, as again Donald Trump was touting, injecting bleach or whatever, you could pour bleach into a test tube and kill off the virus, but if you decided to do that to a human, you'd have as much problems with that treatment as you'd with the virus. So it's kind of been floating around there. I remember seeing there's a Professor Thomas Barodi, who is based in Australia. He's a gastroenterologist who deals with bowels and the guts, and he'd come up with this therapy for COVID-19, using that along with an antibiotic and doxycycline and zinc as well, and saying this is working, although I didn't see any trial data. But there was an interview with him on Sky News Australia, which if you want to look up, you can find it on YouTube. And I say, I think that was back in August. But we didn't have really any studies on this till fairly recently. Just in the last few months, we've been seeing studies come out from all around the world looking at this drug ivermectin, and it seems to have both been shown to work in what's the gold standard of randomized controlled trials, where it's compared randomly allocated between that and a placebo or a standard of care, and also in observational trials between cohorts of people. And we've just been seeing just study upon study showing that it seems to be effective in reducing the chances of you getting COVID-19, the chances of you getting more unwell with it and needing the hospital. And also there was a study that was performed in Florida by a Dr. Rashter, who again showed that patients that were given this drug ivermectin did a lot better in terms of mortality in the hospital. So it's quite a bizarre thing, really, to be honest, that this drug that's been around for years and been used for a very different purpose has, just very recently been shown to have such a big effect on this disease that, as I say, has just killed over 1,500 people in the UK today. So we've got vaccination, which is being rolled out, which is great. The figures on the vaccine suggest they're, possibly 94, 95% effective. But it's going to take months to roll out the vaccine to a significant amount of the population to reduce the spread and burden of this disease on the population. I've heard figures estimate that we may be looking at have to immunize towards 80% of the population before we can control this properly. And that's for most of the vaccines, two doses. And that's, as I say, going to take months. So we are just looking at something that can possibly reduce the severity of this disease, particularly deaths, as a kind of bridge towards that vaccination program.
Yeah, but hang on, because surely the people who've already had COVID don't need to be vaccinated. They surely have already got the T cell immunity. They've got maybe even a few antibodies hanging around in there. Is I mean, why does anyone that's already had it need to be vaccinated?
Well, we don't really know how long the immunity lasts for sure. Yes, you mentioned antibodies. A lot of the studies have shown that they wane after a few months, but there's going to be some memory. So, and you mentioned the T cells, so that's going to be the body's going to be have some memory of the virus, and then be able to ramp up the immune system quicker than if it was, say, exposed to the virus in the first place. It's a little bit of a difficult one. There have been people who have had this virus twice. It might be a small minority of people, but certainly I know and I'm in touch with one patient and one nurse over in Texas, where this has been quite bad, that have both had it twice, and the symptoms have been quite severe the second time. So it is a difficult one to say, and it's we don't really have the data on it yet, but it's possible, one, that we do need the vaccine to boost immunity. And even then, when if you've had the vaccine and not had COVID before, we might need to give the vaccine as a booster at a year's interval. I don't know yet, because we don't have the data on it yet. These vaccines have only been out for a few months, and the data...
I mean, there are some people, Scott, that have been criticising the vaccines, saying, well, actually, these have come out far too quickly, that there hasn't been proper testing because of the background of the international COVID scare pandemic. You know, that there's been corners cut on the testing.
I don't know if there's so much corners cut. I just think things have been done a lot quicker than they would have otherwise. Like, trials normally take ages to recruit to, but we've had stage three trials, particularly for the Pfizer vaccine, with, you know, 40,000 people in each group. I grant that the data is perhaps a bit limited, certainly in terms of long-term efficacy and any potential long-term side effects. But, you know, we're in a war here against this virus that is killing people. So I sat down and, you know, I'd consider whether I should have the vaccine myself, and I decided on balance I should, you know. But I do have concerns myself about the, you know, the long-term efficacy and safety, which that will only come with data as we accumulate it over the next probably year or so.
Okay, so we've also had, I mean, you've mentioned a few different antiparasitic drugs there, mm-hmm. which by serendipity, it seems, can really make a difference when it is at the early stages of people catching COVID to, you know, basically decelerate the multiplication of the virus inside their bodies. Doxycycline, chloroquine, and also, ivermectin.
Yeah.
So, you know, what, is there any actual difference in the efficacy of these three?
Well, doxycycline's an antibiotic. So I've not really come across any strong data on that alone. Hydroxychloroquine, as I kind of mentioned before, was the thing touted towards the beginning of the epidemic, and probably got a lot of media attention because,
well, it got through Trump, didn't it? Trump said, "Oh, yeah, I'm having this stuff," and everyone kind of ridiculed him. Or at least the press did.
Yeah, well, he said that early on in March. You know, said we've got, I can't remember his words, but something along the lines of a game changer. But the only real data was not great. There's this Professor Ruelt out of Marseille in France who was giving it along with another antibiotic, I think azithromycin and zinc, and saying he was keeping so many people out of the hospital. But without you know, a control group to say this is working, how can you say these people wouldn't have needed not to go to hospital anyway? So there's been a number of studies on the hydroxychloroquine. We think it may only work, if possible, if given early, because the pharmacology is, if you take it, it takes days to achieve a reasonable level of the drug in the plasma and the blood. And the recovery trial, which investigated this, along with, they've got a few other arms, as I mentioned before, what the one thing they've proven that works in hospital is dexamethasone, found there was no benefit and possibly a slight tend to harm of giving hydroxychloroquine in the hospital. But the ivermectin is the, I'd say it's kind of been hiding below the radar for a while. It's not been advocated by Trump or anyone like that, but as I said before, there's more and more studies coming out suggesting it really does work.
Okay, so why is it that something that's designed to kill off a parasite, you know, maybe a worming drug, can be effective in the case of a virus, which is actually a completely different part of the body? It's in the nose and the respiratory area rather than in the gut, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's interesting. We have drugs that work for various conditions already. You know, I could give you one drug that was, say, developed for angina, hypertension, high blood pressure, which was Viagra, that is actually used largely for a completely different indication, mainly nowadays. But as I say, drugs can work in different ways, and it appears the pharmacology of action is probably multifactorial for ivermectin. It seems you've probably heard of the virus has got these spike proteins on its surface, which allows it to enter cells through the ACE2 receptor. It seems that ivermectin can bond to these spike proteins and prevent it entering cells. And there's also some suggestion that if the virus does get into the cell, can inhibit transporting proteins into the nucleus of the cell as well. So we think it's multifactorial. It's very interesting. And as well, in the later stage, once there's not many viruses, but we think there's probably an anti-inflammatory action of ivermectin. So it's quite amazing, really, that this drug is just sort of come out of, well, not quite nowhere, but from another, a drug that's been around for ages, used for another purpose, and might be a saving grace in this pandemic.
Amazing. Well, I mean, I suppose the obvious question to ask is, how come this isn't like mainstream news and all places around the world which are treating COVID patients are starting to at least trial it, particularly with early patients? We don't seem to be hearing anything about this. Why is that?
Yeah, well, there are places around the world that have been issuing this, I suppose, on the back of the earlier data. These are largely or mainly South American countries. It was quite interesting to see when ivermectin was started distributed in some of these countries. And this was actually data we looked at, not just in young people, but people over 60 years old, that as soon as ivermectin or soon after ivermectin was distributed, the death rate started to plummet. And that's not just in one country, that's in several regions. And we've also seen the same in a region of India called Uttar Pradesh. I think it's the largest state in India. Now, there could be issues with underreporting of cases, but they've got a population of something like 230 million. And comparing that to the death rates in the UK for similar ratios of population, it's just quite...
So why is this drug finding its way into South America and India, but not to the UK?
To the UK? Well, it's trying to get the word out about there. And people aren't, unfortunately, believing that in some cases that we've got enough data. I think as it stands, we've got randomized controlled trials on it from various different countries, Bangladesh, India, Iran, totaling, if I can remember correctly, over 2,000 patients. The difficulties getting the word out, we've got a few people working on this, actually independently reviewing it. There's Dr. Andrew Hill out of the University of Liverpool, especially. But the difficulty is getting the word out. I, as early as I think it was the 18th of November, sent the paper we've been working on this with our group, the FLCCC, to Sir Jeremy Farrar, who's a member of SAGE, ask him if he'd look at this, and also forward to the Oxford group, seeing if he'd set up a bigger trial on it. Despite him initially getting back to me, acknowledging it, I've heard nothing further back from them. And we've also had a Zoom meeting I was just on earlier this evening with Dr. Tess Laurie. She's an independent, like a medical statistic reviewer. She's got a company called the Evidence Based Medical Consultancy, which I think is based out of Bath. And she reviewed all this data herself. And if I can give you one summary that she's come to, this is completely independent of us, that She said there is moderate certainty evidence that ivermectin probably reduces deaths by an average of 83%. So the data is there, whether people want to believe it or not. But I say that we need to get the large health agencies involved in this. My colleagues, Dr. Corey and Dr. Marek, have taken this to the NIH in America, the National Institutes of Health, last week, and they say they're going to make an announcement or decision on it in about a month while people are dying. As I say, we just had a Zoom meeting earlier this evening, and we're going to decide how we try and get the information out there. It's just very hard to get the information out there unless you're, get it in the mainstream media, or a frontline politician or whatever.
Well, hang on, Scott. Things shouldn't work like that. You should be able to get in touch with Sir Jeremy Farrar at Sage, and if these reports are of, anything up to 85% efficacy of an incredibly cheap, easily available drug, should be being looked at immediately. Maybe in a month's time.
Well, the maybe in the month's time was the National Institutes of Health response, and that's the American organisation. But I don't know. We can only send the data. These people are he sits on SAGE, which is the premier advice group to the government over all of this. And it just broke my heart that seeing so many people dying every day, and there's possibly something we have here that could be saving lives.
Okay, well, I mean, we can ask our listeners to forward the report that you mentioned. Where can people find the ivermectin report online? And maybe they can just pick it up, email it to, or post it to, or phone up and read it out to somebody who can and maybe get something done about this.
Yeah, well, our fortuitous day, our report, or it's actually a scientific paper, has just been accepted and published after peer review in Frontiers of Pharmacology, which is a respected medical journal. Tessie's report, which is her own independent report that was actually not commissioned or anything at all by us, is on her website. I don't have the website in front of me at the moment. Let me just see if I can find it. That's www.e-bmc.co.uk. Andrew Hill of the University of Liverpool, I understand, is due to release a preprint of his data and statistics within the next few days. So that's not been released yet, but I can forward that link to you once it's available.
Okay, so you've been talking about this FLCCC, which you're part of. Can you just round up, Scott, by telling us a bit about that?
Yeah, so as I said, we're a group of doctors, many of them more prestigious than me, professors in medicine. We're led by Professor Paul Marek, who's chief of pulmonary, lungs, respiratory and critical care at East Virginia Medical School. And there's a few other critical care emergency doctors in the US, and another one of us in the sort of core group of this in Norway. So we've just been sort of got together sort of around April or so, just sort of, as I said, banging our heads together to try and work out treatments. It was initially treating people in hospital, how you treat these people in hospital to reduce deaths. But as I said, lately we've been more focusing on, after the data has been emerging on ivermectin, how we can actually stop people getting to hospital, stop people getting to the stage where they turn blue and, might end up, they might recover, they might die, but if they recover, they might end up with significant long-term health problems. So it's all about, and none of us are in this for any reward financially or anything otherwise. We all just do it in our own time off our own backs.
Done. I mean, and there are quite a lot of people who have been looking to make money by one means or another out of this pandemic. Finally, what does FLCCC stand for, Scott?
If I get all the C's right, it's Frontline COVID Critical Care Alliance.
Dr. Scott Mitchell, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks very much for hosting me.